You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Welcome, normal people, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. And our topic today is getting inside the head of Paul and Jesus. And our guest is Sarah Rudin.
Yeah, we have an interesting conversation with Sarah, who is a PhD from Harvard University in classical philology. And she was at the University of Cape Town as a lecturer in classics. She's written a few books, and just a fascinating conversation. She's clearly very bright, and I really appreciated her ability to maybe kind of cut through the noise sometimes, I think, of academia and just kind of come to some really creative and interesting insights.
Yeah, I mean, namely about translating the Bible, and that may sound boring, but that's maybe only because a lot of translations are boring, and that's sort of her part. She doesn't really say that. She's too nice. But instead of just trying to be like mechanically accurate, and that's one thing that a lot of translations have in common. They say things a little bit differently, but they're very similar in terms of this mechanical attention. She tries to enter into the head of the ancient person, and you know, that sounds a little esoteric, but it's really not. It is an act of imagination, but it's an informed.
Yeah, it's very practical too. It seems like as she was talking, I just kept thinking, well, duh. I mean, I think
yeah, exactly. It makes sense, you know, because these are real people trying to move other people with their words. And that's the thing that a lot of translations miss, you know. One thing I was thinking about, Jared, is that, you know, like how can we get into that just with our own English Bibles and stuff was sometimes I tell students, like, just stand up and read it out loud as if you're reading this to people and actually trying to convince them of something. And even if the translation isn't great, that at least maybe reproduces a little bit of the sense of what this biblical literature was really intended to do. It was an attempt to persuade people on an emotional level, not just on, say, an intellectual level. And that's – if I had to capture it, that's what I think Sarah was trying to bring to the table through her vast experience in translating Greek and Latin classical texts and then turning your attention to the Bible and coming at it from just a very different point of view than most conventional translation committees come from. I'd love for her to do a Bible, like Robert Alter we had on a few weeks ago.
Yeah, who did the translation.
Right. And just do like a New Testament like that. And what would it look like? I would love to read something like that.
Yeah, let's get to this conversation. I'm really excited for you guys to hear from Sarah here on getting inside the head of Paul and Jesus.
In a couple places, he makes dirty jokes. For example, you know, in Galatians, he wants his critics castrated, and he's on the subject of circumcision, and he just loses his temper, and he says they just ought to go castrate themselves. This did lead me to want to look at the scriptures with fewer presuppositions.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Sarah, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. So, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners a bit and just, you know, who you are and what you do and, you know, maybe even how you got into this whole issue of translating things. That'd be really interesting to hear.
Okay. Well, I guess I have to describe myself as a hayseed translator. I'm from rural Ohio. Uh-huh. Both my parents are from farms, and I was raised in Wood County, so surrounded by fields. Though pretty early on, I imbibed this urge, you know, to learn ancient languages, and I'm still not sure where I got that urge, but I was quite a pretentious child. So, and anyway, Bowling Green State University was close by. My father was teaching there, so I was able to start learning Latin at 16, Greek at 18, and started a PhD program at Harvard at 21. I was trained in what they call philology, which is the study of texts. not language, that's linguistics, but philologists are concerned with, well, classical philologists are concerned with Greek and Roman texts. So, yes, I was trained in that, but I was always more interested in translation, which they don't allow you to study at Harvard, or they didn't at that time in the classics department. But I was a poet from a very, very early age, I would say. My mother says, you know, from the age of one or two, I was composing poetry. I started publishing it in my late 20s. And, yes, I was just always absolutely fascinated with the sound of words.
So how did that intersect with maybe a little bit of your faith upbringing? Get a little bit of your upbringing with philology, but how does faith fit into that?
Well, I was raised a Methodist. I became a Quaker around the age of 30, and it was only some years later, this was after I returned from 10 years in South Africa, that I became interested in sacred literature. And this does have to do with my Quaker faith. It was through a Quaker institution, Pendle Hill Quaker Study Center, that I began exploring the letters of Paul, because Quakers wanted to know more about them. And it actually suited my take on literature to start exploring, and the Quaker tradition as well, to start exploring from brass tacks. I'd always, as a poet, been concerned with originality. I didn't want other people's words. And this is a bit of a strange obsession when I was a kid. You know, I would listen, and people would always seem to be saying the things that other people said, and it irritated me. So part of my poetic development was to figure out other ways to say things, and that helped me, I think, in thinking about things in different ways. And this led me to Quakerism, helped lead me to Quakerism, because, you know, Quakers, they emphasize silence. We Quakers think that in the presence of God's love and power, there isn't a lot that human beings can initially say. We worship in silence. We sit together, and we wait on God's will. So this did lead me to want to look at the scriptures with fewer presuppositions. Institutional, ideological, personal, all the things that are brought to the Bible that may not have been there originally. So I was very, very pleased that Quakers, you know, asked me, well, what can you tell us about Paul?
Yeah.
That we didn't know, that we're not going to learn from standard translations.
Yeah, so Sarah, I mean, back up a little bit, because you said that you came to an interest in sacred literature a little bit later. So after you came back from Cape Town?
Yes.
I think, is that right? So at what point roughly in your life did you start getting interested in translating and dealing with the New Testament, let's say? And then also on top of that, the Hebrew of the Hebrew Bible, right? Because your background is Latin and Greek, and you just sort of picked up Hebrew?
Well, no, it's kind of a longer story.
Okay.
Yes.
I hope so, because there's a lot of discouraged students out there who think somebody can just, well, I mean, you have a background in languages, so you know how languages work, and you're going to pick up things a little bit more quickly probably. But
Right. I emerged from Harvard not academic. They didn't really know what to do with me. Because here I was a poet, I was a translator. This is, at least back then, I got my doctorate in 1993. At least at that point, you couldn't sell a classical philologist or somebody from a classical philology program to a university for a junior professorship. It just didn't work. Things were not interdisciplinary enough at that point. So here they were, you know, trying to sell me to somebody. And the only department in the world that was buying was the classics department at the University of Cape Town. So off I went there, and there was just too much political upheaval for the classics department even to survive. So I got off the tenure track after 3 years, but I stayed in South Africa because I had fallen in love with the country. It is fascinating. It is beautiful and it was wonderful. And so I stayed nearly 10 years in all in South Africa, between 9 and 10 years, and did all kinds of things, you know, business, volunteering, medical. I did some medical writing and editing. And but I really got to work on my classics translation while I was there. But I really eventually wanted to come home, so came home to the U.S. and then spent some time at Pendle Hill as a resident student in this Quaker institution, and that is where they began, purely by accident. It emerged that yes, I could tell them about Paul in the original Greek. So yeah, I thought, wow, I'm going to write this book. So I wrote a book called Paul Among the People, which is about, here's a subtitle, Paul reinterpreted and reimagined in his own time.
Hmm.
That is, I was trying to get into Paul's head.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, what did you find there with your own approach to translation that maybe others hadn't thought about, or just something that caught you by surprise, or just something that if you're trying to capture Paul for other people, you know what I mean? How would you present Paul and is just who he is to people who might just be interested? What insights did you gain?
Well, you know, I was already used to getting inside authors' heads, or at least trying to. So I had published several classics translations at this point, and I still am interested in the reform of ancient literature translation generally. So when you're translating, say, Virgil, you're translating the Aeneid, you read the text in the original, and this was Latin, of course, and again, read it again and again, and you think about the author in his own cultural context. You think about his struggles as an artist. You think about just all kinds of things, and you try to make an emotional connection to him. Emotional connection for me is more important. I mean, we factually, linguistically, we kind of know all about these authors. You know, all that work has been done. There are mountains and mountains of scholarly publications and very, very good commentaries, you know, line by line, exactly what it's likely that he meant by this word or that word. But to see this author as a whole, and more importantly, to hear him, you got to think about him as a person. You have to enlist as his servant, if you will, as his interpreter for the world. And this is the thing that I thought from a very young age had not been done properly. Hmm. You have these dutiful, dull Penguin classics. You know, you have these condescending translations for the masses. And yeah, okay, in a clunky way, they are accurate. But they do not bother at all with aesthetics. And the reason these works are important is that they were, to their hearers, gorgeous. These authors were the rock stars.
Hmm.
They were the most exciting thing going. Saint Augustine describes his Virgil fandom. How, you know, as quite a young kid, he's reading Virgil in school, and he adores it. He's so excited about it. He's caught up in the tragedy of Dido. This is the Phoenician queen with whom Aeneas, the Roman hero, proto-Roman hero, is in love, and he has to leave her, you know, to go to Italy and found what will become Rome. So Augustine is, this is his great sin, his temptation, his attachment to the beauty of Virgil. So
you're trying to recreate that beauty for somebody like Paul, for readers today, to really maybe move beyond things like, yeah, this is linguistically accurate, or this is historically accurate, but you're not reading Paul, really. Right? Because you're not in his head, or you're not really recreating the aesthetic or even the emotion of reading Paul.
Right. Yes. Now, and Paul, for Paul, that's very important, because, you know, you read him. I'm for reading sacred literature as books. That is, forget for a little while about, you know, no matter how precious it is, forget for a little while about the liturgical use of these books. Forget about the Bible study. That is, you take a little passage and you go into that. You deal with things piecemeal. This is the normal way they're dealt with. I'm for reading sacred literature as books, continuously, as stories, so that they have something like, in translation anyway, they have something like the original flow. They have something of the dynamism, so you're going from here to there and, you know, taking a not only a narrative but an emotional journey, not only an argumentative journey but an emotional journey with these authors. And this is, I think, the way that you see their world. And Paul is really interesting in this sense, in that he's got a really distinct personality. He's bad tempered. He's got a sense of humor. He is very at times he's very tender, very loving toward his followers. At times he's absolutely fed up with them.
Is he sarcastic?
He's sarcastic.
Thank goodness. That's my love language. That's why I like Paul so much. Anyway.
Yeah. He's self-righteous. And
not then, me.
And
no.
Then he,
oh no, go on. Yeah, go on.
And then he backs off from it. And this is kind of the inspiration of Paul, in that he knows his faults, yet he's still to some degree under the control of them, but ultimately not, because he never allows them to get him down or to distract him for long, to deter him. He goes on and on. That is the miracle of Paul, that he keeps going.
So I hear what the phrase that comes to my mind is putting Paul kind of in his emotional and aesthetic context, where there's this like spiral of interpretation, where we're kind of trying to extrapolate from the texts themselves kind of the ethos of Paul, and then that may shape again how we go back and reread that text. My question would be, how do we avoid, or how have you found avoiding putting your own kind of emotional or aesthetics? You had talked about kind of not going to it with presupposition, but when we get in this realm of aesthetics and emotion, it feels pretty subjective. So how do you navigate that?
Right. Well, how I handled it, how I continued to handle it with sacred literature translation, is that I try to build a huge amount of context. Now, you know, when you're in a classical studies doctoral program at Harvard, they just cram you with books. You read all kinds of things. Great, great variety. So I do have in my head, in storage, you know, a lot of a great many pagan works. And I tell biblical scholars that, you know, I respect their work tremendously, but they haven't read the dirty books. It is true. They haven't. Yeah. You know, try to find a professor at a divinity school who has read Aristophanes or Petronius or the Priapus poems. And there, I got to be fair, you know, that in recent generations there is more experience with popular literature, but it'd be very hard to find a biblical scholar.
And those things kind of put meat on the bone, so to speak. It is giving you this broader context in the world in which Paul lived, where, like for me growing up, we sort of put the Bible outside of space and time, and by reading it next to Aristophanes and other things, you're sort of making these connections, it sounds like, that gives you this fuller, more robust picture that's not two-dimensional, but makes Paul human, with human emotion and the ups and downs of all of that.
Right, yeah. I mean, when you think of him, he's, in a couple places, he makes dirty jokes. For example, you know, in Galatians, he wants his critics castrated.
Yeah.
And he's on the subject of circumcision, and he just loses his temper, and he says they just ought to go castrate themselves or be castrated. I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, I think it helps to understand he was raised in the midst of a pagan culture. Tarsus was an important port city. So he's in a Jewish household, but he's just surrounded by the pagan culture, and he does have pagan literary education. So in that context, you know, you go to dinner parties where pretty much everything, anything goes, you know, and you drink and you make jokes, and it's a little hard to place, well, impossible, in fact, you know, to place Paul precisely. Okay, so who did he associate with? What would he do? You know, what were his limits as an observant Jew? It's really hard to tell. The diaspora is really complicated. But, you know, he has a sense of humor that you can find parallels to, you know, in all kinds of pagan authors. You know, he definitely has this, you know, rhetorical manner. So he's just kind of grabbing at anything. You know, he needs to get attention. He needs to be clever. He needs to, he's arguing, you know, to the pagan world, with which has a very high standard for entertainment. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of balance him out in this way and say, well, this is like this author, this is like this genre, then you have a whole lot of evidence. You've got a whole lot of support for a new cast that you want to put on a passage of his.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell, you have some confidence and say, no, this isn't just me.
Yeah.
I'm not just goofing off here. I'm not just entertaining myself and doing something different for its own sake. No, I actually have some support here, and I can build a whole structure of rhetoric in which to imagine him.
Yeah. And I think imagining him is a helpful phrase, because, I mean, we shouldn't fool ourselves. This isn't about objective historical study, but it's trying to dive into the time more deeply and drawing some conclusions about how you might want to present this person. That has some verisimilitude. You know, it makes sense, even if you don't know completely. Now, some might say, well, that's really taking sort of a subjective kind of risk, and we want to be more accurate. But of course, that's nonsense, because, I mean, I think the way, you know, many Christians that we, you know, deal with, and we're familiar with these communities, like Paul in his context, I mean, while he's got the whole Greek thing happening there, the Hellenism, he's also got the Jewish part, and you have to remember those two things. But in at least in popular thinking, it doesn't go much deeper than that. But you're actually trying to imagine what Paul's influences might be that can never make it into a history book, right?
Right, yes. And I think influence is important here. You can't say that you're translating in the true sense, I believe anyway. You can't say that you're doing this if you disregard the author's will, the author's drive to communicate. And this is the problem that I have with standard translations. If they are flat, if they are dull, if they don't reflect the mood and the sound and the performance of the original, you know, this song and dance that the author, every ancient author, you know, very energetically went through, you are really not collaborating in what that author meant to do. And on the evidence, did very effectively for his original audience.
I'm Chuck Hess from Denver, Colorado. Like what you hear? Consider becoming a patron. For as little as $1 per month, you can help support this podcast. Sign up at patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople. I love supporting The Bible for Normal People, a podcast that constantly stretches my thinking about the Bible. Although I don't agree with everything that's said, it forces me to genuinely reconsider my convictions about God and the Bible. If you can't afford to financially support Pete and Jared, then consider sharing this podcast with others. If you're really feeling inspired, rate this podcast on whatever platform you use. These actions help spread the podcast to others and broaden its reach. I would like to take the remaining time to thank our producers group, of which I am proudly a part. This group offers insight and feedback to Pete and Jared in order to make the podcast the best it can be. Of special note, we'd like to thank Skip Sorelli, John Thomas, Peter Hack, Peter John Avis, Amy Obrist, John Aldrich, Jonathan Lee, and Christopher Zenner. And now, back to what you've been waiting for, more of Pete and Jared.
Yeah, I mean, there are a ton of reasons why that might not ever happen in Bible translation because of marketability and keeping constituencies happy and things like that. You don't want to be too risky. But do you, which is a shame. Do you have, okay, this is the worst question to ask somebody like you, but I'm asking it anyway. Do you have a favorite English Bible translation? I get asked that all the time. My answer is always not really. But, do you have, if someone were to ask you that question, just someone in the Quaker meeting would ask you, what's a good English translation for reading Paul? Do you have an opinion on that?
No, not really.
Yeah, no.
in the book after Paul that I wrote about Bible translation, Face of Water, I compare the different ones, and it was, different, very popular Bible translations. And it was a very, very depressing experience because you would take Bibles that you would think would be quite different, Jewish Study Bible, for one, a Catholic Bible, the New Revised Standard Version, and, say, the Revised Standard Version, a whole array. And you would find that they look almost identical.
Uh-huh.
They are just making, in a typical passage, tiny adjustments. And this is very frustrating for me when we now can see, for example, in the Lord's Prayer that you have that line, give us this day our daily bread. Daily is definitely not on as a translation. The word can't mean that.
Really?
Yes.
You just ruined my life. Go ahead, explain that further.
Yes. No, it means...
Everyone out there is dropping to their knees right now.
It probably means tomorrow's bread. It's literally the bread that's coming on. But it doesn't mean daily. That was just a sort of mistake translation of convenience since then.
So does it literally mean tomorrow's, like the bread for the 24-hour period? Is it something more metaphorical?
I think that's the best. No, the best translation would be tomorrow's bread.
I've heard it like eschatological bread.
Oh, yes. No, see, it's a compound word with ousia in it, and it was misdivided. They made an error in construing that word. So
made the error?
Well, it was
in ancient manuscripts.
In the Vulgate Bible. So this is the Latin Bible. It appears in the it's being put together around the end of the 4th century AD.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vulgate Bible was to become standard in the, throughout the West.
Right.
In Western Christendom.
This is Jerome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was, by this time, the error had been established that they would see in this Greek word the part of it that looked like ousia, which means the essence. So the other part they saw was epi, on. So the compound they saw was on the essence, instead of what it really means is going toward.
Oh.
But... mm-hmm.
So it gives it that future sense.
Yeah, yeah. So Jerome, anyway, was convinced that this meant the panem super substantialem. So give us our bread that is transcendent. So it is epi, super, ousia.
Yeah, being, like super being.
Super being, yes, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So he saw, he had made this into a metaphysical bread.
Okay.
And it's pure error. There's no chance that it was meant this way by the author.
So what does tomorrow's bread mean? What do you think that means? Getting into Jesus' head, I guess, is what we're doing now.
Right. Yes. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
She's the philologist. She just points out all the mistakes and then asks everybody else to figure that out.
I guess more theologians. I wish more theologians would say, I don't know. That's a good point.
I should have an opinion. I wrote, I was composing all these experimental translations for the book Face of Water.
Face of Water.
I said, the next loaf. Our loaf, the next loaf, give it to us today. And I related that to the anxiety of ordinary people for getting their next ration. So you're talking about loaves. It's not bread, but it's a loaf. That's really important. So you have these standard loaves. They're made with molds. So and you get the loaf as a ration from the household. So if you're a slave, you get your bread or your loaf or your hunk of loaf, and they're perforated. So they rip apart. It's kind of a pie shape. So you get your wedge of bread as an individual, if a loaf is being broken up. So or you get also you get loaves as a dole from the state if you're poor. Hmm. So these are the people who are hearing and speaking this prayer. You know, they are lowly people. They are slaves. They are poor citizens. They are foreigners. People throughout the empire, and so the some of the archaeology that's happened shows that if slaves who were laborers were more or less starving, they weren't fed enough. So think of the point of view of somebody who is, you know, he gets his ration and eats it pretty fast or maybe saves some, but as soon as he gets it, he's thinking of the next one.
Yeah.
So it's a plea for God to be there continually providing.
Yeah, we can count on you.
Yes.
Okay, that's really interesting. My goodness, yeah.
Okay, well, I appreciate the deep dive into this particular verse, but something you said earlier has, it just struck me in a way that I hadn't thought of before.
And you can't let go of it.
I can't let go of it. I got to test this. So you keep coming back to authorial intent, right? The intention of Paul, the intention of Jesus. And what I hear you saying is maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, so that's why I want to test it with you. But what I hear is in the history of translation, we've talked about authorial intent, but we've really only talked about like half of it, which is kind of the, I would call it like the logocentric side of it, where it's like we assume they're always just like constructing arguments and we're trying to like pull the emotion out of all of it because that's kind of the less risky thing to do. It's the more, quote, objective thing to do. But what I hear you saying, which I think is fascinating and I'd never thought of it, and I think it's actually really valuable to say, is that if we're trying to understand authorial intention, we can't strip it of its emotion and its aesthetics and its, there's some texture that I think we are scared of. And in order to be quote unquote objective or mechanical or accurate, we've lopped that out of the equation. And I hear you saying we need to bring that back because these are people who are writing these things. And if we're talking about their intention and what they were trying to communicate, communication is more than just words on a page or more than just the logic A plus B equals C. There is a lot more to it than that. Would that be a fair way of what you were saying?
Yes, that's very helpful. I think that is a fair way. Yes. So when you're thinking, you're thinking not only of a authorial intent, but you're thinking of the reception of the text.
Right.
And mm-hmm. reception studies have become really important in recent years. So the really fascinating thing to me about, one of the fascinating things to me about sacred literature is its very excited reception.
Hmm.
This is, and for the New Testament, this is particularly important. What was it about these books that brought such an exciting message, you know, such a warmly received message to so many people throughout the Roman Empire? And these were people, you know, from very different backgrounds, but they responded, you know, with tremendous enthusiasm to the message, but also the form. And, you know, one thing I can't repeat enough is that form and content are more closely fused in ancient literature.
Hmm.
You're going to school, okay, you're a typical boy in the educated classes, and the main thing you learn all through school is literature and speaking and how to express yourself. And this is not really about argumentation. It's more about formal speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about ornate and performative and dramatic speaking.
Isn't the point of that? I mean, this is, I mean, I know a little bit, but not very much about this, but is the point of this to make an emotional appeal?
Mm, yes.
To sway people and not just to like convince them logically, but you want to almost draw them into your way of looking at things and on an emotional level, right?
Right, right. So as a typical use to which this education was put, was speaking in the law courts. And in the law courts, the law, the technicalities of the law, the letter of the law meant diddly squat. You would only refer to it, you know, very occasionally. Mostly you were going in there and telling a story and putting on a song and dance and bringing people to your point of view. Now, that's your point of view as an individual. Sacred literature is very different in that it's built to communicate on all occasions and to all kinds of people. So it is a supercharged rhetoric. It is of an intensity and an applicability, a breadth of applicability that really has no comparison. So, you know, imagine the challenges to a simple-minded translator thinking about the enormity of this literary achievement and how did you start approaching it. You know, I must be crazy.
Can I make a leap here? I want to see, because I think there's also, I keep thinking of, you know, I love hearing about translation work, but I also know, like, our listeners aren't really ever going to go try to translate the Bible, but I see some parallels and even, like, things like, I started in my mind with, like, Shakespeare, where even though it's written in English, in some ways, I think it needs a translator for a lot of people today, like figuring out what it means. Like, you know, when you talk about the wittiness and the sarcasm of Paul, I feel like some of that gets lost with Shakespeare, which seems ultra formal to us today. But what he was really trying to do is, you know, was widely recognized in his own day in a different way than maybe how we would see it. And I wonder, when we think of the New Testament and the Old Testament and people who just read English, like, what are some principles that you've learned in your translation work that might help people approach the Bible differently, even if they're just reading it in English? Because I think some of what you're saying, even as I think about the New Testament in English, some of what you're saying to kind of make Paul human and understand it that way impacts how I would even read it in English. So do you have other ways of thinking that may help people who aren't going to translate but just read the Bible in English?
Oh, well, read my books. She says shamelessly.
There you go.
I'll give you an example because
we teed that one up for you, didn't we, Sarah? Yes. That's it. All right.
Yeah. I do not see anything in the original text that other scholars do not see.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right there. You can find it in footnotes. There are ways that you can get at it, but my goal is to make it much more accessible. You know, to bring it out, incorporate it in that translation. If it can't be expressed, and there aren't many cases of this, but then if it can't in any way be expressed English, then an accessible footnote will do. But that really hardly ever happens, and I'm just continually tearing my hair, you know, when I see what hasn't been, you know, could easily be included in a passage, but hasn't been, because people are nervous. They think about the reaction of the Sunday school class and of the Bible study class, and they think, oh no, I can't. But mm-hmm. You know, I'm a Quaker, so what can they do to me? You know, I'm not part of that culture. And in fact, you know, I do a lot of lecturing and discussion with mainline churches, Catholic churches, evangelical churches, and, you know, that I find in, you know, my actual experience that, you know, even quite conservative readers of the Bible are not resistant to translations that are more accurate and mm-hmm. more nuanced, more literary, and they're kind of tickled, in fact, to find out that in, for example, in Matthew and Mark, there's the scene of Jesus with the Syro-Phoenician woman. Mm-hmm. So she is of Canaanite extraction. She's Phoenician, so, you know, huge differences from Judaism. And she barges in to Jesus and demands for her daughter.
Yeah.
And he, in standard translations, makes this really cutting remark, tells her that she's asking that the children's bread be tossed to the dogs. That doesn't say dogs.
Really?
It says little doggies.
Little doggies?
It's not kunes. Little doggies. It's not
little doggies.
It's not kunes. It's kunaria. Kunes would be an insult. you know, dogs, filthy outcast animals, so unacceptable ethnic groups. Fine, that would be an insult, but that isn't what the Greek says. The Greek says kunaria, which is a rare diminutive. This is the only time it occurs in all of Scripture. These two incidences, these two twin.
So it's both
stories.
In Matthew and Mark. It's
Matthew
in both.
And Mark, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is a word that you would find in Aristophanes. You find it in a sort of comical passage of Plato. And it means little doggies. And it's a funny word. It's a cute word. And she throws it right back at him. And he's apparently delighted. And he says, because of what you said, your daughter's healed. Get out of here.
Mm-hmm. So maybe take a second and reframe. Right, so there's one way of taking this, which is Jesus is insulting this woman, and she kind of bitingly comes back, and it's a very serious episode. So given this change, even in that one word to little doggy, maybe give us a sense then of the tone and the tone and the texture of this, and how is it different?
Okay, you have to go and look at the literary context. This is a process that I was describing before. So you have to go to other examples in ancient literature to see what the tone is of this word and how it's typically used. So it doesn't mean puppies. It's not simply little dogs. It's cute little dogs. Lap dogs. So you got to think, we're two removes, cultural removes. This is not a term that you could easily imagine the historical Jesus saying. So he's speaking in Aramaic, and he's a provincial Jew, a pious one. So he doesn't, you would think, have any conception of lapdogs. This is what we're really talking about, lapdogs, in the Greek or Roman experience. So this is not what he's saying, but the tradition has it. He said something that the Greek author or the Greek speaking author interprets as cutie dogs, lap dogs. And in pagan literature, the dogs being fed under the table, the dogs getting scraps, are getting them at some kind of joyous, very generous, very rich feast. Mm-hmm. So we're talking, okay, theologically about the eschatological banquet. This is the feasting in heaven at the end of time. And there is so much food there that, you know, even the dogs under the table, they get stuffed. And that's the image that you find in comic literature, such as the novel The Golden Ass, mid-second century AD. So there's a wedding banquet on this. The bride is rescued from fearsome kidnappers, and she's a very rich, very noble young lady. So the whole town just has this wild feast, and this is the best thing that's ever happened. You know, that she is safe and she's married, and the dogs are rendered just helpless and bloated. They eat so much. Yeah. That's the ultimate joy. And you gotta, you know, think about the general poverty that prevailed in the ancient world. You know, you feast and you eat meat, you know, a couple times a year if you're an ordinary person and you're kinda hungry all the time. But and then for the dogs to get enough. That's amazing. So, you know, think of this in relation to the people of the multi-ethnic audience, mainly of people with pagan backgrounds who are reading the Gospels as the Christian religion spreads. And this is themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are included. They are heirs to the kingdom also. Everybody, the most ordinary people. And they can imagine, you know, a banquet in which, you know, it never stops. And no one is lowly enough to be excluded enough. No one excluded before is going to be excluded now.
Yeah.
I think it's a very tender passage.
Yeah. It becomes more tender and more hopeful than more like a concession that Jesus makes, which is that's the morally troubling part of that for a lot of people. Like, he seems to be not treating her very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. Well, listen, Sarah, this is I feel like we're just getting started here. There's so much here to just rethink some things in the Bible by using, let's say, an informed imagination for thinking about what these things might mean that we take for granted. But we're coming to the end of our time here. And do you have an online presence? Can people find you online? Can they stalk you somehow?
I am at sararudin.com. That is my website.
Okay.
And my books are all shown there. I'm working on number 10 or 11. It depends on how you figure it. Some are written with other people. And some of my poetry is there. So yes, I would love people to visit me there.
Wonderful. And the information on your books and other kinds of things too, like when maybe your speaking schedule or things like that on there too, or
I do not put my speaking schedule on there.
Oh, you should get that up there.
Probably should get that.
Yeah.
Get that up
there. That way people can say, oh, she's in my area. I'm going to go listen to her. So it's fantastic. So.
Right. Well, yeah. Yes, if anybody is interested in me speaking, visiting, the information is there about how to contact me. And
wonderful.
I am very delighted to visit, you know, any kind of religious group, any kind of institution, and to share about my work. Yes, and I do this. It's my great delight to talk to a great variety of people.
Well, and same here. So listen, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, it's great to have you on.
Yeah, wonderful. We learned a lot, and it's just fantastic. So
thank you so much.
All right, Sarah, thank you. See ya.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Bible for Normal People. We really appreciate all of your support. And if you want to continue the conversation and get involved more in the community, you can head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com. There's all kinds of blog posts written by mostly Pete, some of me, but also you can find us online if you don't want to go to, you know, that's kind of old school, going to a website. I mean, that's like...
Who does that?
Websites.
Yeah.
But you can go to social media. We're there. You can look up Pete. You can look up Jared. You can look up...
Instagram? We're on Instagram. The Bible for Normal.
We're Instagramming all over the place. I mean, it's just...
You can see my cat and my dogs and my grandchildren.
Yeah. So we hope to see you online, continuing the conversation, or back here next week where we have a brand new episode of The Bible for Normal People. See you then.
See you, folks.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.